All right, Shmuel Plotzker here. I'm wishing everybody a good afternoon. Coming at you live from Frederick, Maryland. And here we go, everybody. This is our weekly book club class here at Gulf Meadows Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. And we're doing the book called The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism in American Orthodox. From Yoshua Soloveitchik speaking in 1944. We're in the middle of a chapter known as The Letters of Creation. And we're on page 43. I'll pick it up from where we left off last week. The axioms of the fundamentals of the religion can only be taught to children, not mature people. For an adult to become a Baal Tshuva is highly rare. In truth, it bothers me very little when I see old Jewish gossips on whose faces the imprint of the small shtetl is still discernible, desecrating Shabbos. Not by them will the Jewish community in America be built. I'm no tzaddik, and it does not pain me. But when I sit in a sukkah, and Jewish boys and girls from all over the neighborhood come running to stare at the spectacle, God's wonder. Then do I feel lost and lonely, even though what a sukkah is. Don't drag Jews into the shul, propagandize on behalf of Shabbos, and sermonize about family purity laws, or issue rebuke regarding kashrus. If you convert Jewish children and make them ex-Gentiles, better, you make them ex-heathens. They're not even Gentiles. You'll have prevailed. If instead of hosting conferences and shuls attended by Jews who study the Mishnah and Ein Yaakov, the National Committee for Torah Judaism would teach three Jewish children how to read Shema, it would achieve far more. When it comes to children, too, we must know what it is that we want to accomplish and not wander aimlessly in a world of chaos. I hear talk of starting Gemara classes in Talmud Torahs. This project, too, is misguided. First, the Talmud Torahs will not make room for us. The administrators will advance a rather logical argument, namely, that if Gemara classes are necessary, they themselves will organize them. Second, I have a very low opinion of partnership. Quote, anyone who relies on the table of others, the world has darkened for him. Gemara in Beah 32b. I think what the Gemara over there means, haven't looked it up, but when it says, you're relying on the table of others, meaning that's where you're going to eat. Anybody who's so poor that he's relying upon somebody else's food to feed him, well then, yeah, the world is darkened for him. That's true. Does that mean that a partnership, by definition, is wrong? People are in partnerships all the time. Law firms are partnerships. People partner in Hollywood all the time. They partner up, but they bring their collective abilities to the project. So I'm not such a critic of partnerships. And the Gemara that he's quoting here, I think, is talking about very, very poor people who are depending upon the table of others. That means the food. And so I get the Gemara's point, but I don't think it's applicable over here, if I can be so bold. Third, he writes, and this is the most fundamental point, if the Mizrahi truly wishes to engage in educational work, it shouldn't begin with Gemara. The distinction between our educational ideal and other pedagogical methods does not consist solely in the quantitative difference of a couple of folios of Gemara. I've seen the Gemara classes offered in Talmud Torahs, and despite the extra pages learned, those boys who mechanically repeated the Gemara grew up to be thoroughgoing Gentiles. The entire course of education must be oriented differently, strive in a wholly different direction, and have completely different aspirations. They were raised in a Talmud Torah. They were not given proper basic value education, Jewish education. So they were taught some Talmud, and they prattled it off. They memorized it, or they learned how to read the lines, and that's very nice. And some people would think that that's the end-all and the be-all of Jewish education, to get a kid to prattle off a lot of Gemara, and you see what a great tzaddik this guy's going to be. He'll be a big lamdan. These kids turned out to be tremendous amaratzim. He says, even Gentiles. They didn't grow up to become, you know, functional Jews. And they learned a lot of Talmud when they were children. So what did you accomplish with that? You learned a lot of Talmud with the kid, and the kid never got the basics to infuse him with a spirit of the beauty of being Jewish, what it offers the world, why we're special, why Hashem gave us the Torah, nobody else, and all the beautiful teachings in the Torah that keep on the straight and narrow. Other religions have come along, taken my Bible, and they twisted it, and now it's unrecognizable. Now it's some idolatry kind of religion. This is the fear that you have. You have to go along the rabbinic path, the tried and true path, and appreciate the path that the rabbis have hewn out for us, and appreciate what you got. You have to do this bit by bit, he says. It's got to be from an early age and on. Give you the right spirit, give you the right education. It's not just Talmud study. Here's another proof of what he's saying is correct. Here's more proof. At a certain point in many yeshivas, they start teaching Talmud in fourth grade, fifth grade, okay, sixth grade the latest. And by the time you've reached fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, the vast majority of your daily schedule in Jewish studies is Talmud. That's the reality of it. Because they want you to become good in Talmud so you can get into high school where you'll learn even more Talmud. And guess what happens at the end of the day? You know what you neglect? Basic halacha, Sifrei Tanakh, Chumash with Rashi and the Parsha, of Jewish philosophy, Jewish history, a little Hebrew grammar wouldn't hurt, so you can read stuff. At least you can appreciate a dictic Rashi. Okay, you guys get fluency in reading, that's true. Many do. But then again, there are many who don't. And they go through the motions, and they're told they got to study Talmud, and they do. And at the end of the day, it doesn't touch them for some reason. It's because it's highly technical, and it's very kind of difficult to follow, and there's nothing fun about it, and there's no midrash, and there's no agadata, and there's no nothing, and they wind up question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. At the end of the day, what do they get after years and years of that? Not a whole lot. I've seen it in my own life. Friends of mine, they never got any basics that they needed to get. They didn't get in elementary school, didn't get in high school. And they wind up never opening up a safe for the rest of their lives. What's up with that? And so you become a thoroughgoing Amoritz about everything. It's so sad. You've got to have a different Jewish education. It's got to be broader. It's got to be bigger. Bigger vision. I went to Chappelle's. I was learning so many different things. Tomorrow in the morning, yes, tomorrow in the afternoon, it's true. But in the afternoon, basic halacha and Chumash with Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra. I mean, that was eye-opening. That was great. Got to be a different approach. Got to give kids more skills and more tools. Introduce them to more Sifrei Tanakh, more Sefarim in the Jewish world. He continues, Rabbi Soloveitchik. The child must be endowed with a new soul, not simply taught a couple folios of Gemara. The crowning glory, of course, remains the Oral Torah. But before that ideal can be approached, the entire curriculum must be geared toward it. Our curriculum begins with the Hebrew alphabet, with kindergarten, not with Gemara. If the letters of the alphabet are not studied with the children in sanctity, one cannot later teach them Gemara. There must be a qualitative renaissance in education, not merely a quantitative addition to it. We must found new chadarim, yeshiva day schools, and an evening Talmud Torahs in cities and towns, and educate children there, implanting within them Torah and fear of heaven. Don't be concerned about duplicating the work of the Talmud Torahs. Call them yeshivot if you wish, but in any case, make sure to teach the alphabet and chumash and nurture young Jews there. We must learn from the experience we have garnered these last several years. Rabbi Yitzchak Arama in his Sefer Akedas Yitzchak and Noach says, none is as wise as an experienced person. But before I cite an example of what I mean, I wish to make a clarification that should a priori remove all suspicions that I harbor certain sympathies or antipathies for the movement I'm about to cite. I have sentiments for Chabad that are rooted in my youth. I believe that it was once a great, gigantic movement. I also have boundless respect and awe for the father of the Chabad approach, the author of the Tanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi. May the memory of the righteous be a blessing. I consider him to be one of the greatest philosophers of religion ever to have lived. At the same time, I must note that certain things that are published by the Chabad headquarters here bring the movement no honor. For example, the periodical HaKriya VaHaKedusha unfortunately contains neither Kriya, reading, nor Kedusha, holiness, but rather partly small-town idleness, partly foolish clownishness, without a spark of humor. It would have been better had it never come into existence. However, the Chabad headquarters does one thing on account of which I forgive its leaders all their mistakes and errors. Lubavitch has undertaken a task that could have a recognizable impact on the development of American Judaism throughout the country. It is still difficult to predict the results, but the experiment is grandiose It matters not whether certain Jews tolerate it or are displeased by it. Facts are stronger than sentiments. The Rebbe sends out young men sporting beards and sidelocks, most of them Americans. They arrive in towns where no one has ever seen a Jew with a beard. They set up shop in a shtiebel and pull children in from off the street. After the children's school sessions, they bring them to the Beis Medrash. They ritually wash their hands. They dress them in tzitzis, and they teach them axioms of Judaism. This process has played itself out in Worcester, in Boston, in Bridgeport. And the remarkable thing is that the children enjoy it, and the parents are happy too. Don't ask me questions about the number of children. 35 in Boston, 75 in Worcester, 40 in New Haven, 10 here, and 8 there. The number will grow. And even if not, it's no tragedy. We Jews have never emphasized the quantitative. One of God's favorite attributes is the God of Abraham, the God of one man, of one Jew. I can assure you, though, that the number of students will climb. You can critique, to some degree, the outer trappings of the instruction and the methodology used, but that which Lubavitch does, the Mizrahi must do as well. Take little heathens and learn with them. Do not call rabbis to conferences devoted to strengthening Torah Judaism. Do not convene Shabbos congresses. Dress children in tzitzis and tell them about the God of Israel and his Torah. The problem with Jewish education in America is that it, like Elisha the prophet, seeks at the outset to resuscitate via the staff, stick, via a cold Jew, like Gehazi, who was, of course, Elisha's assistant. The staff, the stick, the rod, the symbol of pedagogical methods, educational scientific approaches, and modern instruction is highly effective so long as the child is still living. But once the body is lifeless, cold, and stiff, the pedagogical staff and stick cannot be used to resuscitate it. At that point, Gehazi, no matter how trained he might be in modern pedagogy, cannot endow the child with a new soul, a new spirit, a new life force. 2 Kings chapter 4, it says, Gehazi had gone on before them and had placed the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. The boy is not awakened, he said. A corpse does not need pedagogy. A corpse needs warmth, a living body to embrace it and build a spirit of life into it. It needs what Elisha did. Quote, then Elisha mounted the bed and placed himself over the child. He put his mouth on its mouth. He put his eyes on the child's eyes and his hands on his hands as he bent over it. And the body of the child became warm. One must mold, consolidate, and warm the child with all of one's Jewish enthusiasm and holy fervor, with one's passionate, all-consuming ecstasy, and the body of the child became warm. The same procedure must be repeated once, twice, and thrice until, quote, the boy opened his eyes, end quote. The issue with American Jewish education is that teachers are too well pedagogically trained. They talk too much about instructional methods, pedagogical approaches, sociological circumstance, socioeconomic factor, and educational scientific points of view. They argue too much about the conflict between home and school, between street and yeshiva, and about the duality and division in a child's soul. They operate too much with the rod, fulfilling the verse, and place my staff on the face of the boy. We must become a bit more naive, a bit more enthusiastic, a bit more unscientific, a bit less pedagogical. The yeshiva as an institution is itself at odds with the most elementary principles of pedagogy. To study Gemara with 10 or 12-year-old children is pedagogically senseless and wrong. And nevertheless, so have we done, and so will we continue to do. And the body of the child became warm. This must be the Mizrahi educational model. The party must require every chapter of the Mizrahi to found a yeshiva day school in the course of the coming year. If the city already has such a school, the Mizrahi should officially join it and work to help it broaden, expand, and participate in educational yetzira. Let's stop there for a second. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself, this man writing, speaking in 1944, excuse me, was later to join up with Rabbi Aaron Cutler, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of the Lakewood Yeshiva, who was the point man in America for Chinuch Hatzmai, or better Hebrew, Chinuch Ha'atzmai. That's right. That's what it means. Atzmai, independent, right? Yom Ha'atzmaut. Chinuch Ha'atzmai, independent education, not the state-sponsored Israeli state instruction. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, years after this talk that he gave, could be he realized that the Mizrahi itself, per se, as a movement, was not really truly succeeding in doing what needed to be done, or it needed some help. And so he joined up with the Lakewood Rosh Yeshiva to enable Chinuch Hatzmai to be successful in Israel. And today it is. There are Chinuch Hatzmai yeshivas all over Israel. Are there Mizrahi schools? Well, certainly there are some. Obviously there are some. There's no doubt that there are. They're all over the place. But maybe they're not truly, truly all over the place. And the Chinuch Hatzmai schools have gone into places where even the Mizrahi did not go. That's possible. That is possible. Because there are plenty of towns in Israel. And there are a lot of people in Israel. You open up a school, so you deal with 400, 500, 600. Okay. What about the other hundreds of children? The Chinuch Hatzmai system in Israel has been a success. And as far as creating functional Jews who know their religion. We continue on page 47. Mizrahi members must know that raising funds is necessary, but that alone cannot sustain the Mizrahi. Hosting Malava Malkas is unimportant, and no time need be wasted on that. In Boston, which is where he's, you know, he was living in Boston his whole life in America, in Boston, which had a yeshiva day school, in Boston, which has a yeshiva day school, Mizrahi members have done nothing on its behalf and continue to do nothing. He's talking about, I guess, the Maimonides school, which he was very much involved in founding, if I'm not mistaken. So he's able to say, in Boston, which has a yeshiva day school, in 1944, there was only one, Maimonides school. For him to be able to say, Mizrahi members have done nothing on its behalf and continue to do nothing, is a shocking thing to admit and very painful. With the exception of one family, he says, which invests truly enormous effort in the institution, we receive no assistance from the Mizrahi organization. I want you to help me understand this. We don't need support. We are, thank God, well off. Jews now give us $5,000 or $10,000. We have stubbornly persevered. It has been a long and difficult road, but we have prevailed. The Yeshiva Day School has become an institution in Boston. Where there's a will, there's a way. We can do without the aid and cooperation of the Mizrahi, but I ask, where is the Mizrahi headed? For such a large party, with such a deep ideology, expect that new Mizrahi members will grow like truffles and mushrooms on refuse and stones. If such a type were to materialize somewhere, he would be, quote, like a lily among thorns. See Song of Songs, chapter 2. Book of Ruth, should you wait for them? Should you chain yourselves to them? Of course, I regularly receive the reply, be patient, we'll organize an appeal, we'll conduct a campaign and raise $500,000. We'll examine the possibilities and circumstances under which a yeshiva day school can be founded. Once we have done that, we'll get to work. I understand the problem. The Mizrahi finds itself facing the old dilemma expressed by Hegel in connection with Kant's critique of pure reason. And here the editor writes, namely, how can reason be used to evaluate how to reason? To what can this be compared, he says? A person wishes to learn how to swim, but he's afraid to jump into the water. As long as he cannot swim, he considers it dangerous to go in. But in order to acquire the skill of swimming, he must get wet. Similarly, on the one hand, one must have money in order to begin the work of education. On the other hand, it seems that an appeal would fail if the Mizrahi would be unable to point to concrete actions and accomplishments. American Jews don't donate to future causes, meaning they donate to causes here and now that have accomplished something, that are accomplishing something. American Jews want to see action right now. They want to be able to donate to an ongoing concern that is successful even as he speaks. Marai Rabotai says, my dear friends, we dare not delay our work until we receive the funds. Do not say when I have the time, because you might not have it. See Avos 4. chapter 2. If the Mizrahi actually begins disseminating Torah among small children, money to support the cause will not be lacking. First, conduct a couple of trials, and then the blessing will flow. Our rabbis say that when Solomon built the temple, he planted it with all the sorts of sweet fruit trees made of gold that would bear fruit in their proper season. When the wind would rustle them, they would release their fruit, and they would serve as a source of income for the Kohanim. See the Gemara in Yuma 39b. In the temple, grow sweet fruit trees made of gold, but the wind, the spirit, the enthusiasm must blow through the trees. The fruit must ripen and fall to the ground. We should not begin straight away in a commercial manner, but should rather, with the cultivation of the right atmosphere, throw ourselves with all our fervor into the work. And when the holy Ruach HaKodesh blows, the sweet fruit made of gold will fall into our lap. The problem is that American Jewry suffers from a remarkable malady, traditionalism. At first blush, it's a young, dynamic Jewish community that has cast off the yoke of Jewish tradition, breaking with a thousand-year history. Here he's talking about reform. And so the malady of traditionalism creates a strange paradox. And yet the diagnosis is unfortunately correct. American Jews have exchanged a grand, sacred tradition, a worldview that embraces the entire cosmos, for quaint ceremonies, silly customs, pedantic conservatism, and senseless conventions. Every society with its own routine, every club with its own practices, every auxiliary with its own tradition. The same Jews who trample the eternal tradition of the eternal nation and desecrate all the hallows of Israel in their hubris are, at the same time, extremely stringent when it comes to their quaint ceremonies. This idiotic traditionalism yields the result that Reformed Jews cannot yet renounce their mission to spread godliness throughout the world, even as they themselves believe neither in God nor in the devil. This foolish traditionalism contributes to the fact that a large Jewish population of over 5 million fulfills its sense of obligation to Judaism with a couple of dollars a year and looked on with supernatural indifference as a third of our people was being murdered. This ugly conservatism and these fossilized conventions meant that two young generations were lost and are now suspended spiritually in a world of chaos as neither Gentiles nor Jews. This absurd traditionalism has made a caricature of Jewish Orthodoxy. For 50 years, it has been occupied with kashrut councils, rabbis, ritual slaughterers, and chevra kaddishas. And even here, it has accomplished nothing. Without understanding the verse in Exodus 13, and when in time to come, your child asks you, saying, what does this mean? This traditionalism has led us to become cowardly, servile, and concessionary. Because of this traditionalism, a Jew who greatly enjoys my sermons on Shabbat Shuvah told me that he cannot labor on behalf of our yeshiva day school because he has been a member of a certain Hebrew school for 20 years. What stands behind all these petty traditions is ignorance, which is actually the pettiest tradition of all. The difference between a grand, sacred, exalted tradition and petty traditions is the following. While the former is proud of the past and hopes for a future that will surpass that glorious past, it's not content with the present, the status quo. It is revolutionary and tempestuous. It wants everything to become better and brighter. Foolish traditionalism, by contrast, does not root itself in the past or look as a visionary toward the future. It has no vision or historical intuition. It is self-contented. It enjoys the present and does not yearn for something better. It is this type of traditionalism that gave rise, to the Cliveden set in England. Not familiar with that. The fifth column in France and the reaction in Poland, and has also contributed to certain people here in this country associating with fascists. Such a traditionalism must be exterminated and entirely uprooted. It's a poison to the people's spirit. It undermines the basis of national existence. It's the traditionalism of idolatry, priest and prophet. There's a famous essay by Achad Ha'am entitled Kohen V'Navi, see in Al Parashat Drachim, Kovetz Ma'amarim, Volume 1, published in Berlin, 1930. In it, Achad Ha'am expounds on the differences between the priest and the prophet. The priest is a status quo man, a conservative, a traditionalist. He believes in the existing institutions, in the reigning order, in the conventions of the present. He bestows his priestly blessing upon everything that already exists and upon that in which the people believe. He swims with the current. He does what public opinion demands. He does not want to refine the public, nor rebuke them, nor elevate them. He wishes to please them. He seeks their plaudits and applause. The prophet, by contrast, has a turbulent nature, a revolutionary spirit that is dissatisfied with the status quo, that protests against the present, that seeks to make the future brighter, grander, and loftier. The prophet is a man who rebels against society, against its institutions and silly customs, and wishes to give it a new Torah, a man who struggles with the world in order to improve and perfect it. He's not interested in public opinion or the plaudits of the masses. He follows his own path, even when everyone else derides and ridicules him. Isaiah 50, I offered my back to the floggers and my cheeks to those who tore out my hair. The priest's life is more comfortable. The prophet, however, prevails. We Jews are, in fact, a kingdom of priests. See Exodus 19. Our conception of a Kohen, however, is not of a status quo man, a priest who sanctions the existing institutions, but of a prophet who thunders against all, quote, you who are at ease in Zion and confident on the hill of Samaria. See Amos chapter 6. Maimonides in Hilchos Klei HaMikdash writes, any Kohen who does not speak under the influence of Ruach HaKodesh and in whom the Shekhinah does not rest should not be consulted. If a Kohen lacks vision and prophecy, if he's a self-contented, satisfied priest without dreams and free of struggles, one should not inquire at his or her Bitumen. He cannot be a leader, and not just a prophetic leader. Gemara, prophetic, says Gemara in Brachas, a lyre hung above David's bed, and when midnight would arrive, a northern wind would come and blow on it so that it would play of its own accord. Immediately he would arise and engage in Torah study. Monarchy, too, requires vision and Ruach HaKodesh. When Shmuel anointed Shaul and gave him the testament of rulership and kingship, Samuel said to Saul, when you leave me today, you are to go on to the hill of God where the Philistine prefects reside. There, as you enter the town, you'll encounter a band of prophets coming down from the shrine, preceded by lyres, timbrels, flutes, and harps, and they'll be speaking in ecstasy. The Spirit of the Lord, the Spirit of the Almighty will grip you, and you will speak in ecstasy along with them. You will become another man. 1 Samuel chapter 10. You hear? A king, young and inexperienced, who was just now anointed, is taught by an old prophet to join a band of prophets. A king who must have the support of the masses and the goodwill of the people, who must have his finger on the political pulse of the subjects, who must enable, defend, and elevate the status quo, who must be a compromiser, appeaser, and politician, who must greet everyone with a smile, is told by his old teacher, the prophet Samuel, to join a band of prophets, revolutionaries, world rebuilders, stormers of the heavens, who wish to tear up the status quo, scrap that which already exists, smash the petty tradition, introduce new forms of life and a new Torah, institute a new order. And he's supposed to not to worry at all about the masses criticizing him, saying, what's happened to the son of Kish? Is Shaul also among the prophets? See 1 Samuel 10. Whom have we chosen? A dreamer? A fantasizer? A revolutionary? A visionary? We need practitioners of real politic. Pragmatic leaders, not dreamers and prophets. And when later on Saul did not pass the test and told that same teacher of his, Samuel, after the war with Amalek, quote, I was afraid of the troops and I yielded to them. See 1 Samuel 15. He gave in to the masses and like a politician, he followed public opinion. His teacher replied, quote, God has this day torn the kingship of Israel away from you, has given it to another who is more worthy than you. Yes, Moray Rabbatai, a political party must become a movement, not of traditionalists, conservatives, and status quo men who are bereft of vision and don't dream, but of pioneers and trailblazers, visionaries, and those endowed with Ruach HaKodesh. We must shatter the petty traditions of ignorance, passivity, indifference, and skepticism. unwitting resignation, plain old cowardice. Kingship, redemption, and Torah are bound up with the ideal of prophecy, with the music of the future, of the lyres, L-Y-R-E-S, not L-I-A-R-S. Lyres, those are musical instruments, lyres, if you will, timbrels, flutes, and harps, with the notes of the days to come, says Isaiah in chapter 2, with a dream that the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. This movement must fulfill Samuel's words, and here I end. The Spirit of the Almighty will grip you, and you will speak in ecstasy along with them. You will become another man. My dear friends, powerful stuff. Spoke in 1944, a long time ago. Things have changed over the past 80 years. Amazing stuff. Tough to think about. Has the Mizrahi fulfilled its goals, as Rabbi Soloveitchik laid out for them in this speech in 44? It's not so clear. I think that the yeshiva movement has eclipsed it by far, created many more yeshivas, taught many, many more children. That explains why you've got a burgeoning community in Lakewood and Baltimore. But at the same time, we must also acknowledge that the Mizrahi schools do exist, that they do an admirable job of teaching their children. And between those elementary schools and the Mizrahi high schools and Yeshiva University, there are burgeoning communities in Teaneck, Englewood, Fairlawn, the Five Towns, pockets of the Muncie area, and scattered throughout the country, Young Israels and other shuls. So both communities, it seems to me, are trying their best to create enthusiastic, committed Jewish adults out of the children that are entrusted to them. May both movements continue with great success. And with that, I'll let you go. I'm going to hit the road. We finished the chapter, thank God. God willing, next week, the next address on page 53 is called Recognition of the Present and Vision for the Future, delivered in June of 1945, when the war was completely concluded. Wishing everybody a great day and a great week. And God willing, please join us tomorrow night for our Tanakh class at 7:30, as we learn chapter 19 of 2 Kings. Everybody's invited, men, women, and children. It's all free and it's all fun. If you come live, you might even get some water. Wishing everybody a great day. Shmuel Popper, signing off now for Belfast Synagogue School of Jewish Studies. Thank you so much, Jake and Mitch, and shiurenjoyment.com for all you do to make these shiurim available on the web. Thank you, everybody who called in. Catch you next week at 1 o'clock for more book club. Take care and be well. Thanks so much for joining us today. Bye-bye now.